The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 6 of this 7-day sesshin here at Mountain Gate, and I'd like to share with you some more of Hakuin's writings as translated by Norman Waddell and published in the book Wild Ivy, the spiritual autobiography of Zen Master Hakuin. Wild Ivy is the name that Hakuin gave to that batch of writings, which was an autobiography he wrote. And I'm going to jump into the middle of it. Hakuin was quite a character. He had quite the personality. It would have been interesting to meet him. At any rate, this is under the heading Exemplars of Zen Practice. Years ago, National Master Gudo, that's Gudo Toshoku, whose name we recite every other day in the Ryoshinji Sogenji lineage chant, a list of masters that have come down to the present day, current person being Harada Shodo Roshi. But since he's not dead at this point, the last person in the list is his teacher, Yamada Momon Roshi. And it is with Harada Roshi that I've been training for more than 20 years at this point, longer now than I trained with Kepler Roshi. Both of them fine teachers. Years ago, National Master Gudo, having completed his pilgrimage around the country, paid a visit to Yozan Roshi of the Shotoku line of Myoshinji. It's traditional now, at least the Rochester Zen Center, to do a pilgrimage at a time when you have completed your formal training. The actual training in Zen never ends. There's always deeper we can go. There's always more clear we can become, more let go we can become. And this is important to realize. It's not something to get depressed about, because heavens, we've already started on the path, and that is huge. How few people come into contact with Buddhism at all, much less with a teacher and a practice that is so potent as what we have here, and to be able to take it and run with it, to do what you can, is a huge gift to yourself and to humanity and to everyone around you, really. And I'm not sure whether this pilgrimage that Gudo was taking was the similar kind of pilgrimage, or whether it was a more early version, which was to go around to various different temples and teachers and practice and test your training. And this is what he's doing now. During his dialogue with Yozan, Gudo felt restricted and constrained. Yozan reviled him angrily and pelted him with scolding shouts. Furious at himself for his unexpected lack of freedom, Gudo stalked away into the mountains behind the temple. He found a large rock and sat down upon it to meditate, determined to sit through to the death. It was truly fine that he took the reaction by Yozan and his own reaction to realize that he really hadn't gone as deep as he thought he had in his practice. He wasn't as free as he thought he was. And to develop the determination to go deeper then. And we can use the same way of testing ourselves in our daily life. It doesn't matter whether it's a Zen master or not that we encounter, but anyone we encounter, our interactions with another person, how does it go for us? Doesn't matter what that other person does, whether it's positive or negative, whether embracing or screaming, really doesn't matter. What matters, what is most important for us as practitioners, is how we receive it and what our reaction is. Do we receive it open-heartedly, taking a look at ourselves to see where we might have been caught, or do we react, wanting to fight back if it's a challenge, or do we get caught in a positive encounter? It's very, very important to really study ourselves and see what our reactions are in each moment, and to see where we can let go more, or we can become more free, we can become more clear, we can not knee-jerk and fight back if it's in such a circumstance that where somebody is being nasty, for example, to us. But rather that we are able to be clear and uncaught by whatever happens, because this is our natural way of being, to be clear and uncaught by circumstance, to be free to respond to whatever comes our way, no matter what it is, whether it's an extremely positive thing or whether it's an extremely negative thing, to respond in appropriate ways freely. And here the important word is freely, and it doesn't mean just doing any old thing that you think about. It means being free of conditioning, of habit patterns, of ideas, especially an idea of yourself, because that's the biggest constraint for all of us, is this idea of who we think we are, because it's not who we really are. Who we really are, as the Buddha said, is perfect, whole, and complete, filled with compassion and wisdom. And the only reason we don't recognize this and put it into action in our activities, in our thought, in our speech, is because it's covered over by these assumptions, these stories, this conditioning. The things we tell ourselves about ourselves, the things we tell ourselves about our relationship with other people. And when we can become increasingly free of those stories, of that conditioning, of those assumptions, then we have increasing space around us in which to truly respond with clarity and wisdom and compassion. And it's amazing what can happen when we do that. It really is amazing what can happen when we do that. And this is what Godot recognized at some level. This is also what Shido Bunan was capable of. Well, we're all capable of it, but this is what Shido Bunan had actually realized and put into action so that he could be totally free when the event that took place that nearly sank him as a human being in relationship to the village he lived in. Why he could be so free and so accepting in those circumstances, wrongly accused, having to deal with the consequences of that for a whole year. And then again, not seeking retribution when it turned out the girl was lying when she said he was the father. Can we be that free? Yes, we can. It takes a lot of work. It takes going right into our body when we feel the reactivity, tuning in to the felt sense of that reactivity. It takes not escaping into the story or into a reaction of anger or nasty words or whatever we're tempted to do. And the results are phenomenal. People can be changed. People are changed. There is a true story that happened to Harada Shodo Roshi when he was a monk in training at Yamanamumon Roshi's temple, Shofukuji in Japan. He was, by that time, one of the four head monks. Apparently there were quite a few people in training at that monastery back then. It was fairly soon after the war. Harada Roshi was born in 1940, so he grew up during the war and in its aftermath. And there was a lot of pain and suffering in Japan and all over the world, really, as a result of that war. And so many, many young men went into the monastery. And so he was one of the four head monks, and there were a number of foreigners also training at the same time at that monastery, two of whom I know personally. And one of them is the person that told me the story, because he was there when it happened. It seemed that they were doing out a work detail right outside the temple gates. The Buddhist temples in Japan normally own more property than is actually within their temple gates. For example, at Sogenji, it's a rather large campus. It's probably about 5 or 6 or 7 acres at least. And it is at the foot of a mountain. And Sogenji actually also owns a fair amount of the mountain up behind it. The property was given to Sogenji by the daimyo of the era to, it was the words, the phrase used was for the repose of his father's soul after his father died. And some of the land over the years was sold off, but there's still a fair amount of land still existing. At any rate, they were out front of the gates working, shovels and whatever. I don't know the exact nature of the work they were doing, but it seems that on the extended property of the temple, there were a number of homeless people living. And there was one person who was in charge, or felt himself in charge at least, of the group of homeless folks. And they had this idea that the temple was cheating them out of water. And so when the work party of monks arrived, this guy, who, as my friend put it, was no stranger to violence, accosted young Harada and was literally in his face, furious, berating him, ready to deck him, really. And in fact, my friend was standing there with a shovel in his hand, and he kept the shovel in his hand ready to swat the guy if he tried to hit Harada. And what happened was so remarkable that my friend still remembers it clearly to this day, and it happened, oh goodness, at least 40 years ago probably. And that was that Harada just got more and more deeply quiet inside, relaxed, simply smiling at the guy, taking in what he said. And what happened next was, little by little, this irate man calmed down. He was ready for murder. But in the face of Araroshi's openness and compassion, quiet, he was able to receive that and respond to it, as people will. There's something called mirror neurons in our brain that enable us to actually feel the feelings that other people are experiencing. And no doubt it was through this physiological ability that this man was able to calm down. But this is the kind of thing that can happen So often we are tuned to react to situations, particularly situations where we feel our image is threatened. It doesn't even have to be our safety. Our image is threatened. Somebody's accusing us of something. Somebody's acting as if we are negative. To be able to be clear and let go in the middle of that is our birthright, really. And we can do it. It takes a lot of zazen to reach a point where we can be free enough of the self-image that we're not driven by it to react. And in this case, to continue, Gudo took matters in his own hands rather radically. Furious at himself for his unexpected lack of freedom, Gudo stalked away into the mountains behind the temple. He found a large rock and sat down upon it to meditate, determined to sit through to the death. Swarms of mosquitoes gathered around, and I have to tell you that in Japan there are swarms of mosquitoes, distracting him and impeding him from pursuing his goal. At Sogenji, in 1 week, three fires were accidentally lit. One of them just about took out the Zendo. That was because it was summer and people were using mosquito coils. I don't know if you know mosquito coils. They used to be around a long, long time ago, before we had bug spray and things like that. But they are coils of, they call them senko in Japan, ko meaning incense, mosquito incense. And they're kind of a toxic stuff. And it burned, it repels mosquitoes. And in the summertime at Sogenji, between every two seats on the tan, there would be a mosquito coil, lit mosquito coil, put. And the guys sleep in the Zendo. That's traditional. And one of these guys, I guess, grew hot in the middle of the night and tossed off his covers. And these mosquito coil tins come with a cover with slits on it, but apparently he did not have the cover on his. And so the cover of the sheet or whatever it was he had over him that he tossed off landed on the mosquito coil and caught fire. And he woke up with flames all around him, was able to get the comforter or the sheet or whatever it was out of the Zendo and dump it in the ditch where it consumed itself, and the pillar in the Zendo next to which he was sleeping was charred. But at any rate, that was the third event in 1 week of people accidentally having problems with fire. And fire is an enormous thing at Sogenji, in Japan in general. And in fact, after the Kobe earthquake, which killed thousands of people, many of them burned to death, because when the earthquake happened, it broke pipes, gas pipes, and many of them caught fire, and the fire raced through these traditional old wooden buildings. Fire has traditionally been a terrible event in Japan. It has taken out whole cities because the housing has until more recent times been out of wood, and even modern houses are built largely of wood. So it was a serious thing, serious enough that the Roshi ordered that all of the mosquito coils be brought to him, and we did not have access to mosquito protection after that. And before that, there were always 5, 6, 7, 8 mosquitoes buzzing around your face, biting you, and it's a serious thing in Japan to have mosquitoes. They cause a kind of encephalitis that is incurable, and we heard a lot about that because one of the close neighbors of Sogenji, Kunitomi-san, her husband is is a pediatrician, and there were many times when he had children in his practice that he had to send to institutions because they had caught that encephalitis and there was no cure. And they were brain damaged as a result. So once we had no mosquito coils, it was very clear that they had worked indeed. And instead of 7 or 8 mosquitoes around you, you had clouds of mosquitoes. Blessedly, after a week, the Roshi let us have the mosquito coils back. So Godot was really putting himself in quite a position. And what did he do? He stripped off his garments and without a stitch on his body steadfastly resumed doing zazen. Mosquitoes from all parts of the mountain now descended upon him in great black clouds. They pierced his skin, they sucked his blood, subjecting him to untold agony. But he just stretched his backbone straight as a ridgepole and sat on with even greater determination. It was like one person battling a host of 10,000. Suddenly, without warning, he died the great death, his body and mind falling completely away. He had attained the great emancipation. When dawn came and he opened his eyes, he saw that his body was covered with mosquitoes. They were so thick, the color of his skin could not be seen beneath them. He began slowly and calmly to brush them off, and they dropped to the ground and lay around him like a thick carpet of crimson red cherries. Beside himself with joy, he began stamping his feet and swinging his arms in a wild, involuntary dance. He returned to Yozan, presumably with his clothes back on, and gave him a detailed account of the realization he had attained. Sharing with Godot the intense joy of the moment, the master gently patted him on the back and confirmed his attainment of the Buddha Dharma. In later years, Godot served as abbot at a number of temples, including the Shodenji and Daisenji, and greatly stirred up the true wind of the Zen school. He was a solitary peak who towered abruptly over his contemporaries, superior monks beyond count, great and heroic men all, issued from his forge. There was one in particular, an illustrious son who outshone even his illustrious father, his name Shido Monan Anju. Shido Monan is the man who was accused of fathering the baby. Monan produced 3 Dharma sons and heirs of his own, Dokyo Eitan Rokan of the Shojuan Hermitage in Iyama, with whom Hakuin trained. Tetsuzui Osho of the Zenkaiji in Matsuzaki, Izu Province, and Chomon Osho of the Bo Daiju in Sumpo. A virtuous man long ago said that, quote, the arduous struggle undergone by the worthies of the past has a radiance that will unquestionably grow and prosper. Words of indisputable truth. How could National Master Godot have achieved the great and glorious accomplishments he did if he had not run up against the venomous teeth of those bloodthirsty insects? This is Hawkwing's personality coming forth here. Or opened all those countless temples and training halls? If the bitter struggle engaged in by those of the past is right, the withered up do-nothing sitters of today, whether silent illumination and great peace and happiness, are dead wrong. Take someone like my own teacher, Shoju Rokan. There was once a woodcutter living near Shoju's hermitage at Narasawa who came upon a wolf cub while he was out working in the mountains. He carried the cub home with him and fed it, and soon he became deeply attached to the little animal. He set out into the forest one day, followed by the now devoted young wolf, to cut down a large tree. The wolf lay down nearby and waited as the woodcutter set about his task. By a freak accident, the tree toppled suddenly in an unexpected direction. The woodcutter looked on helplessly as the main trunk of the tree landed directly on top of the wolf, crushing him. Overwhelmed with grief and remorse, the woodcutter could do nothing but sadly dispose of the lifeless remains and return home. Beginning that very night, wolves from all corners of the province began gathering around Iyama. They ran wildly across the countryside in packs large and small, their eyes glowing fiercely with anger and resentment. Each night they descended into the village. The streets were alive with wolves. They stole into houses and dragged children 4, 5, 6, even 7 years old outside, where the pack would set upon them and tear them to pieces. The next morning, remnants of the bodies would be strewn about the streets. Their wolfish vengeance knew no bounds. At first sign of darkness, the villagers would shut themselves inside their homes and bar their doors and windows fast. Not a soul dared to venture outside. All movement in the village ceased. Witnessing these events, Shōjū recalled the life of self-negation the great teacher Shūhō Myōchō had led on the riverbanks near Shijō Bridge in Kyoto. A good chance, he thought to himself, to test the strength of my religious mettle. He went to the village cemetery where the wolves congregated in great numbers, fashioned a seat of grasses, and sat down upon it to meditate. He vowed to continue sitting for the next 7 nights. When darkness fell, wolves in numbers beyond count gathered at the cemetery where Shōjū sat, their dark shapes padding around him on all sides. Suddenly, two or three swerved away from the pack and darted straight for him, hurtling over his head only at the last instant. Wolves began sniffing at his throat, butting and poking at his back. He could feel their warm snouts brazenly nuzzling up and down his legs and around the soles of his feet. Icy fear gripped his liver. His knees quaked like jelly as the beast probed and tested in 1,000 different ways. Shōjū never once flinched or wavered through it all. He even sensed a secret joy upon feeling the courage and strength stir within him. And he sat unharmed right through until the end of the 7th and final night. I heard this story from Shōjū himself one evening while we were drinking tea together. And how about the life of self-negation Myōchō Daishi practiced on the banks of the Kamo River? Myōchō would test the strength of his religious purpose by repairing each night to the neighborhood of the Shijō Bridge and performing zazen seated on a cushion of grasses. The capital was plagued at the time by gangs of young street ruffians. They would gather in groups of 3 or 4, arguing the merits of the swords they carried. And from there they would proceed down to the river and run through the reeds, testing their swords by cutting down hapless beggars and outcasts they happened upon. Great numbers of such people fell victim to their blades. One day, a band of these marauding hoodlums stole unperceived into the area near the Shijō Bridge and saw Myōchō meditating on his grass cushion. He seemed an ideal victim. "I'll strike him first with the long sword," one of them called out. "Then you can take your turns." The villains approached the seated figure, threatening him, their weapons poised to strike. Yet Myōchō showed no indication of fear at all. He just kept sitting bolt upright with a calm and blissful lack of concern. This is someone who is truly, truly let go. One of the swordsmen paused, lowered his weapon, and stared long and hard at Myōchō. Suddenly he pressed his palms together before him in an attitude of veneration. If we caused the death of this praiseworthy man of religion, it wouldn't be very much to demonstrate the sharpness of our blades, he said. But we would be committing a horrendous sin. And with that, they dropped their swords and fled. Myōchō has a poem about this period in his life. "Hardships still come, one upon the other, enabling me to see if my mind truly has cast off the world or not." Hardships still come one upon the other, enabling me to see if my mind truly has cast off the world or not. And the thing is, we can jump to a conclusion that casting off the world means we're going to go into a sort of a nowhere place where we won't really fit into society or anything else. And that's not the case at all. In the 10 ox herding pictures, which is a visual portrait of levels of practice, the final picture is not a kensho. The final picture is after, it's two pictures after the kensho, actually, when a person has had the chance to integrate their realization with their daily life. And the final picture is the person who's been through all of that work, all of that hard work, experience kensho, perhaps multiple kenshos, most likely multiple kenshos, certainly multiple insights beyond kensho, and integrated it with their daily life, male or female, it does not matter. And they're returning to the village with, as it's said, bliss-bestowing hands, going back into the hurly-burly of daily life to live a normal life, but in such an awakened state of mind that without lifting a finger, other people are inspired, other people are awakened as well. Suffering is relieved because they're not caught anymore on their own stuff. And in the past, as you heard, you know, some of these stories are somewhat embroidered by Hawkwing, who loved to tell a good story. But the inner truth is still there. Gudo Toshoku really was dismayed at his lack of freedom when he was tested by a master. And so he took it upon himself to do what was necessary. And, you know, being Japanese, they like to do these extraordinary things like sit naked in a field of mosquitoes. But he did it in order to bring himself to deeper level of awareness, deeper level of awakening. And the same with Dokyoetan. I doubt that there were thousands of worlds, but there was probably at least a wolf pack. And the wolf pack really was terrorizing the village of Iyama at the time. And he really did go to the cemetery and sit to test the level of his let-go-ness. And he sat, even with the wolves breathing down his neck, sniffing at him, potential to rip him apart. But there must have been something about him that made them hold off and not do it. And in a way, we have to be careful about these kinds of tests. I actually know of a young woman who had a kensho. I don't think it was very deep, but at any rate, she had a kensho and decided to test it. So she walked into a hotel in the wrong part of San Francisco and ended up having to jump out a second-story window to escape a couple of guys. So we need to have our senses about us, too. It's not just about taking enormous risks. But it is about whenever we have an encounter with someone or something, even receiving a letter or an email that's disappointing, we want to go into our body and feel the full extent of that disappointment, not as an emotion, but as sensation in our body. And stay present with it until it releases, lets go. And as part of that process of letting go, it will probably reveal to us, although it doesn't have to and it's not necessary, and it may not, reveal to us exactly what we were caught with, why we were caught, and give us a clearer picture, a clearer understanding of the truth of the matter, where we would not have been caught. This is a gift of our practice, and it is a tremendous gift. To be able to relieve any amount of suffering is huge. And that's what our practice will do. The extended out-breath, the susokan, is a huge asset with that. Both keeping us centered as well as we reach through it and let go in order to extend that out-breath, it brings us more and more into a mind of clarity. Now, that clarity may reveal some places where we didn't realize we were caught. So it's important to recognize that too. Because as we practice more and more deeply, we're going to see more and more clearly. And we're not just going to see nice things. We're going to see where we have not been so cool in our behavior, in our speech. And with that will rise regret, and also, most likely, a decision not to go there again. Just as Godot also recognized he did not want to be caught again in that way. He wanted to be truly free, so that even if somebody was nasty to him, even if somebody yelled at him, it wouldn't be a problem. This is what Hakuin is trying to tell us as well. And Hakuin practiced for decades. He started when he was 14, right? When he was in his 50s, he had his final Kensho experience, the one that truly liberated him. The 19th one. We are so privileged to have encountered this practice. We are so privileged to be able to sit the sesshin to the degree we've been able to be here. We are so privileged to have the time to be able to really give ourselves to this practice. And the more we can do that, the more free we will become. And hopefully we will continue to do this practice again and again and again and again, because each time it will bring us deeper and open us to more clarity, and with that clarity to more freedom. This is our birthright. We have everything we need to accomplish this, even if it feels like we can't. And I can tell you that for years and years and years, I had a feeling of hopelessness about my practice. And I only did it because I knew there was no alternative. I had realized, as some of you already know, some months before I ever began practice, that there was never going to be anything in my life on the outside that would bring lasting happiness. There was nothing I could do, nothing I could own, no relationship I could enter, nothing would give me lasting happiness. The only way I could achieve any measure of freedom and joy in any lasting way was to go inward. And so, because I had no alternative, I was willing to do it in spite of the sense that I couldn't. And thankfully, after some years, that sense that I couldn't dissolved and went away. There is such gratitude for this practice, and I cannot imagine ever stopping it. Every sesshin, there is more clarity, more opening, more let go. And this is the same for each of you. You've all been working very, very hard in this sesshin. It's been truly heartening. And as part of that working so hard, each of us, you've helped to support the practice and enhance the practice of everyone else. Because that's how it works. And this is perhaps why people have gathered since the time of the Buddha to practice together. Because it's so much more powerful than practicing alone. If we have no alternative, then to practice alone really is still vital. And it's vital anyway, because I don't think any of us can be in sesshin every moment of the day, of every day of our life. And to be sure, we need some time off to integrate and also to test ourselves to see where we're still caught. But to be filled with gratitude for the practice and to give ourselves as completely as possible to it brings tremendous results. On the door to the Zendo is a calligraphy done by Harada Shodoroshi. It says, great effort without fail brings great light. Great effort without fail brings great light. May we all continue infinitely opening to this great light. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.